Today's episode, part 15, is entitled Britannias.
A change came about at this time. Up until then, we used to carry stewards rather than stewardesses, i.e. the cabin crew were all male. But then it was decided to do what the other airlines were doing and employ stewardesses. Strangely enough, as far as we crew were concerned, we weren't very keen on the idea. We thought it would spoil our little male jollies in the future. Nevertheless, it happened, and we still on occasions had a male chief steward, but the rest of the cabin crew were girls. We got used to it, and it was nice to have attractive girls around the place. Inevitably, it led to several liaisons amongst crew members. Now we were flying round the clock, no more spending nights in hotels with the passengers. This was the first time in human history people had been subjected to such an unusual routine. There were no flight time limitations, so we could fly up to about 18 or 19 hours as a duty day, and that would be at any hour of the day or night. You were obviously sleeping and eating at different hours of the day or night, eating different types of food, so it was almost like an experiment to see how people could survive given these conditions. Also, there was the added factors of different temperatures, climates, etc. The business of flying hours was a contentious issue even in those days, because there'd been some accidents attributed to the aircrew having been on duty for too long. I remember one duty day, defined as from when we signed on an hour and a half before departure to half an hour after we landed, that covered 21 hours. You couldn't imagine asking anyone to do that now. Because of the time it took to get to and from places, that's the way it had to be.
After flying Argonauts, I converted to Constellations, which were wholly American aeroplanes. As the Americans did not carry navigators, they didn't have a proper navigator's position, so one was installed at the front of the passenger cabin, which was a bit embarrassing with passengers watching whilst we worked. The next plane I flew in was a Britannia, a revolutionary new aeroplane because it was a turboprop with a jet engine driving a propeller. Being revolutionary, it was very late coming into service and took about 5 years to develop to flying condition. Eventually it arrived and it was a nice brand new aeroplane, British made with a decent payload. I think it carried about 100 to 120 passengers in its full version. Unfortunately, it developed all sorts of problems. I won't go into all of them, but a problem with the engines caused problems all over the place. It was so bad that when we were rostered on a trip, you never knew when you'd get back or where you might get stuck with aeroplanes in places all over the world. About now, BOAC decided that they wanted to get rid of navigators too. They had a surplus of pilots and wanted to train the pilots to become navigators so that they could fulfil both roles. Obviously, this wasn't to our liking, especially as we had to train the pilots. Our Britannias operated between Hong Kong and Tokyo using an electronic device called Loran, which was tricky to use. In order to train these pilots in its use, they posted two navigators at a time to Hong Kong. And as crews passed through, we would join them and train the pilots in navigation. I was in Hong Kong for 6 weeks, and there should have been three planes a week. But because the Britannias were so unreliable, only about eight of them got as far as Hong Kong, and none of them went any further. It was really chaotic. Eventually, we got a later, bigger version of the Britannia, which was much more efficient, although, like most British planes, a bit on the thirsty side, but at least it worked all right.
With this version of the Britannia, we started doing transatlantic routes. Up until then, these routes were a kind of a closed shop. There was a separate fleet for the North Atlantic flights, which operated as an exclusive entity, and the crews involved considered themselves a cut above everybody else. In those days, organisations such as churches, sports groups and the like could charter a plane to fly across the Atlantic, and we did quite a few of those. I remember we had an ecclesiastical group on one occasion, and the stewardess told us that when it was announced they were on a final approach into Heathrow, they all got down and prayed, and the leader of the party led a prayer for the crew up front, which amused us all. We'll leave flying now and go back a few years to what was happening on the home front. Alan was on his own for quite a while. Pam came along when he was 7. He provided his mum with company when I was away and, by all accounts, was quite handy about the house. Then Pam came along and she was a completely different kettle of fish. She was so quiet that we hardly knew we'd got a baby girl. 18 months after that, of course, along came Caroline. This reminds me of another aspect of a flying career. A doctor can work it out roughly when a child is going to be born, but you can never be sure. I was actually flying back from West Africa just before Alan was due, and by the time I'd landed, he had already been born. At least I was able to go and see him fairly soon after I got back. With Pam, I was a bit further afield, Nairobi or somewhere, and I got back about 24 hours after the birth, so again, I wasn't there at the time she was born. When Caroline came along, I was further away still in Hong Kong because Doreen jumped the gun again, and on this occasion, mother-in-law rang up BOAC, who were very good. They sent a signal announcing the birth and even gave me the weight, and then said I could get the first plane home as a passenger. There again, by the time I got home, it was a good 36 hours after Caroline was born, so thanks to the job, I was not at home for the birth of any of them.
By now, we'd decided the bungalow was too small for us, and that we needed bigger premises. So we looked around, everywhere from Broadstone to Barton, some houses fitting the bill in some ways but not in others. Finally, we bought the house in Brackendale Road. It suited us because I knew the area well, and it was handy for schools when the kids grew up, and it was a reasonable-sized house. Our solicitor advised us to offer a lot less than the asking price, a ridiculous sum if necessary, and see what happened. If I remember rightly, I offered $4,000 and after a lot of negotiation, eventually got it for $4,300. Ridiculously cheap by today's standards, but a lot of money then, but £500 cheaper than it might have been. We soon settled in and found the area very amenable. Schools and shops within reasonable distance, and there were nice walks out the back across the playing field and woods. This remained our home for the best part of 40 years. I was on Britannia's for quite a long time, 7 or 8 years, I think. But by that time, of course, jets were coming in. The Comet had been flying for some years, Boeing 707s were around, and the Britannia was fast becoming an old-fashioned aeroplane. Whilst I was flying them, our time as navigators came to an end as BOAC finally decided they had enough pilots trained in navigation, so we were given the chop. Being made redundant in our job wasn't a very pleasant thing, because navigators were beginning to be phased out across the industry and replaced by electronic devices, so the chances of getting another job looked a little slim. However, I did apply for one or two jobs. One was with an Irish airline. Fortunately, I didn't get it, as it folded soon after. I'd become a member of the Navigation Union's committee, and I happened to be at Heathrow for a meeting when one of my colleagues from the union committee said he'd got a job with British United Airways, BUA, and told me they were still looking for people.
I put in a job application and was invited to an interview at Gatwick Airport. One of the interviewing panel was George Seaton, who had been my sidekick when I was a navigation instructor at Jerby on the Isle of Man. I don't know whether it influenced my getting in, but I did. And I started my new career with BUA under the command of the charismatic Freddie Laker. BUA was still operating Britannia's, so it was a relatively easy transition for me, just a case of getting used to BUA's ways of doing things, which were a little different. Freddie Laker was very much a man who didn't like to see anything wasted, and therefore things were cut to the quick in a way not fortunately from the safety point of view, but he certainly didn't believe in waste of anything. He counted every kilo of fuel he put on board and such like. Pilots were marked on how quickly they taxied in and out at airports. Navigators were marked on how much fuel they could save. It amazed me that all the crews absolutely loved Freddie and would do anything for him. They thought he was a bit of a so-and-so in many ways, but he had charisma, and a lot of them had been with him from when he first started up, on the Berlin airlift, for instance. It was amazing how loyal they were to him, despite calling him some names at times. When I was in BOAC, BUA and the other independent airlines were often considered solely for throwouts who couldn't make the grade with BOAC and were looked down on. But I was surprised to find that the crews in BUA were far more professional than those in BOAC, and that suited me just fine.
Now, I was with BUA and we were still flying Britannias, which I'd been used to in BOAC, but rather more interestingly, we did more charter work, especially across the Atlantic. And by that time, the Britannia's problems had mostly been sorted out, so it became a good old workhorse of an aeroplane. Anyway, at that stage, BUA under Freddie Laker began to change. It had been taken over by some shipping firm, I can't remember the name of it now, and they decided to run it on what they considered proper lines, rather than Freddie Laker's idea of running it on the back of an envelope, virtually. He didn't believe in a board of directors, he believed in running things himself, so he didn't last long. Not wanting to work for someone else, he preferred to do it all himself. So off went Fred, and we had one or two people in charge. There was Alan Bristow, the helicopter man, who took over at one stage, but eventually it was taken over by Caledonian Airways, which is when it became British Caledonian. This entailed quite a lot of differences of opinion between the navigators from Caledonian and ourselves as to what sort of seniority we should have and what sort of salary we should have, as clearly the two companies had been run under a different sort of structure. Of course, I was still on the union committee at that time, and we had quite a problem to sort it all out. I think we managed, if anything, slightly in our favour in the end, which meant we had a slight increase in salary.